LAN, also known as LAC, by and through her guardian ad litem, and the people of the state of Colorado, in the interest of minor child, LAN, versus the respondent, LMB. I'd like to take care of a few housekeeping matters. First of all, the argument is set for an hour, half hour side each, and you'll have to keep track of your time as petitioners. Secondly, when you talk and start your argument, please tell us who you are and who you represent. Thirdly, we would appreciate it because of the nature of the case if you stick to initials, both all of you, in terms of relating some of the facts. And then for the benefit of just the lawyers, the audience knows this, we have these iPads, which we're using, or some of us are, and we're not up here surfing the web, just so you know that. All the briefs are on here, pertinent parts of the record, as well as connectivity to the cases you've cited and statutes through Westlaw Next. So with that, we'll begin. We'll hear from the petitioner.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Laura Prusetta-Gypson, and I'm an assistant city attorney in Denver. I'm here on behalf of the people in the interest of LAN. I'm also joined by co-petitioner, the guardian ad litem, Amy Packer, and Sherry Vans from the Office of the Child's Representative, who will be arguing as amicus in this case.
I'm sorry, as to what?
Who will be arguing as amicus in this case. When one considers the relationship between and the interest of the parties in a dependency and neglect case, the Court of Appeals holding below that the child's guardian ad litem has the authority to waive or assert the child's psychotherapist patient privilege in a dependency and neglect case strikes the people as a correct and logical conclusion.
Ms. Hodgson, could you do us a favor,
certainly,
particularly for our audience, could you please give us a factual scenario setting for what's really involved in this case before you?
Okay, yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
In this case, the Department of Human Services in Denver filed a petition of dependency or neglect in December of 2008. The minor child at that time was 7 years old and was suffering from mental health issues. She was out of control. She was very aggressive. She was even making suicidal statements. She had been taken to Children's Hospital, and the respondent mother in the case didn't agree with the kind of treatment that the child was supposed to be undergoing, left with the child, or tried to flee with the child.
The purpose of the dependency action that you filed was what?
The purpose was to provide services to the family. The court, after the filing of the dependency neglect petition, would have to make a determination either through the admission of the parent or a trial that the child was in fact dependent or neglected, and that services would be required to be provided by the Department of Human Services, that the juvenile court would have jurisdiction to make certain determinations regarding the child's welfare.
And what would that be?
In this case, then, what would happen is, in this case, the respondent mother did enter an admission eventually, and the trial court thereby gained jurisdiction over the family and the child, and at that point adopted what's called a treatment plan for the respondent mother. The court also had to make determinations regarding the child's placement and whether or not the child could be returned home, because in this matter, the minor child was removed from the parent's custody and placed with relatives. The treatment plan, once it was adopted, would be reviewed by the trial court. The court would be then looking at whether or not the respondent mother was making progress on the treatment plan, whether changes to the treatment plan were necessitated by the actions either of the child or the parent, and eventually whether or not the court would need to adopt a permanency plan, and that could be returning the child home, placing the child with a relative under an allocation of parental responsibilities, a permanent custody order, or the department could file a motion to terminate parental rights, and then the court would have to determine whether the criteria for termination had been established by clear and convincing evidence, and then the child would be free for adoption.
And did I understand right that what's at issue here with regard to disclosure of the information to the parents or to the mother was actually a termination hearing, is that right?
Yes and no, Your Honor. The termination hearing was where the issue arose eventually, but the document and the records in, that form the crux of the case here were, it was a letter written by the child's therapist addressed to the guardian ad litem in February of 2010. At that time, the permanent plan was return home or eventually a few months later, an allocation of parental responsibilities to the relatives, the grandparents with whom the child had been placed. At the time that the letter was introduced, the issue before the court was not termination of parental rights at all, but rather whether family therapy should take place in the home of the respondent mother or whether the family therapy should continue in a more neutral setting.
And the Court of Appeals ruling that we now have before us, was that reversing a termination order? What was that?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. And one of the concerns that the Court of Appeals had is that, in quoting it, it after finding that the guardian that there was a waiver of the privilege and that it was the guardian ad litem who waived the privilege, after finding that it was the guardian ad litem who held the privilege and who could either assert or waive the privilege, then found that the privilege was waived with respect at least to all material in the therapist's file that supported, related to, or contradicted the therapist's statements and opinion as presented in the February 18th letter and the therapist's testimony at the termination hearing. We do believe that that was in error, in part because when the information was distributed to the parties, the other parties, as well as filed with the court, frankly, as the Court of Appeals conceded, no other Colorado court had ever ruled prior that it was, in fact, the GAL who had the waiver, had the authority to either assert or waive the privilege on behalf of the child. And when you look at the privilege statute in comparison and also in conjunction with the Children's Code provisions, the Children's Code does anticipate that certain reports will be filed with the court because the court cannot make determinations, the parties cannot make recommendations to the court without some information regarding the child and how he or she is doing in therapy. That being said, and there are other cases that talk about disclosure and discovery in a civil action, the fact that certain pieces of information can be shared does not open the door to sharing of everything in the therapist's file. Since
normally, who would be the holder of the privilege? Could you explain?
Normally, it would be the parent. And
the parent, because the child is how old, too young to make that determination yourself?
The parent would be the holder ordinarily because we're talking about a minor, and especially in this case, a very young minor. The child was not just about 9 years old at the time of the termination hearing. So the juvenile court, in facing the dilemma with the request of the mother's attorney for access to the therapist's entire file, including all the therapy notes that which would reflect the child's statements to the therapist in therapy, which is supposed to be privileged, the trial court made the determination that that would be too much, that especially in this case where the child had significant trust issues vis-a-vis the respondent mother, sharing all of that information would not be in the child's best interest. That being said, the court did recognize that the respondent mother, given that by the time of the termination hearing, we were talking about a protected liberty interest, does have a right to due process and does have a right to defend against the motion to terminate. But as the trial court further found, access to the entire file was not necessary in order to allow the
mother. So what's at stake in this case, really, is the concern of the therapist and the court for the welfare of the child, and to what extent can you reveal the information that the child has given to the therapist over a long period of time, right?
Absolutely.
Well, and the mother's right to due process, after all. And the problem becomes more acute here because the mother has a conflicting interest to the child. And therefore, we're trying to address something that is not spelled out in the statute or even our case law, correct?
That is absolutely correct.
And the Court of Appeals said the whole file had to be turned over, right? The whole therapist file. What was the basis of their ruling? What was the reasoning?
The reasoning seems to be, and I think it was somewhat mistaken, is that the therapist letter, the February 2010 letter, was advanced in advocating for termination, both by the guardian ad litem and the department. The court decided that it didn't need to reach the issue of whether the department had the authority to claim or waive the privilege on behalf of the child, but did find that the guardian ad litem, by tendering the letter to the court, did. I don't think, in fact, I think most of the parties don't really take issue with that holding in terms of who would possess the privilege in a dependency neglect case, because as the court has recognized, there is a conflict, and certainly by the time you get to termination. Clearly, the parent has an interest in holding, in having that relationship maintained, and the child has an interest in a safe and permanent home, and in this case, the guardian ad litem as well as the department believed that that could not be in the home of the mother. When you look at the transcript, it's clear that the respondent mother was able to extensively cross-examine the child's therapist without having been given access to the therapist's notes with regard to each and every therapy session. And in this case, while the trial court might have been mistaken in terms of finding that it had the authority to to assert a limited waiver, that being said, even if you shift that to say that it really was the guardian ad litem who could or did, the fact that the guardian ad litem shared the letter does not mean that the waiver has to be interpreted as broadly as the Court of Appeals did in this case.
I understand we're talking here about the expanse of the waiver and what would cause the waiver, but can I back you up just a little? What's the rationale? Well, first of all, how did the guardian ad litem come by this information, and what's the rationale for why the guardian ad litem would be entitled to learn about this information?
Well, under the Children's Code, when you look at the provisions regarding disposition for the child, the statute, the Children's Code itself, anticipates that reports will be prepared, that information will be shared with the court so that it can make determinations regarding the child's best interest. So I think there is a statutory basis for sharing some information.
And that's for the guardian ad litem to share information with the court, or
I believe it,
the court.
I'm sorry. It would certainly be the guardian ad litem, but I think it goes beyond the guardian ad litem as well, just in looking at the dispositional provision as well as the guardian ad litem provision that talks about how...
And goes to whom then? Are you saying that because of that statute, the therapist was required to share information with the court? I guess what I'm trying to get to is, as you said initially, the privilege runs to the patient, not the therapist. So
that's
the therapist
fair.
Has to maintain the confidentiality unless the patient or somebody who has the right on behalf of the patient wants to disclose it. How did we get from the therapist to the guardian ad litem?
Well, I think we got there via the trial court itself. And I think when the court was looking at the reports and in ruling on the mother's motion to quash the therapist subpoena, or responding to the therapist motion to quash, I should say, the court looked at what had happened up until that point in time. The child's therapist had appeared in court, the family therapist had appeared in court, the social worker had appeared, and all were disclosing information about how things were progressing, what issues were being addressed. So at that point, we didn't have the benefit of the ruling that it was, in fact, the guardian ad litem who held the privilege and was the one in a DNN who could either waive it or express it. But based on the fact that the court had requested input from the therapist, then it held that there was a limited waiver. And the Court of Appeals looked at that and interpreted it as being requiring a much broader waiver than was, I think, certainly anticipated by the trial court and any of the parties below.
So if I could just follow up a little, because I wasn't really clear from the briefing either. So the therapist actually provided confidential information, privileged information, to the court in open court?
I don't know if it was privileged information in terms of just how broad the disclosures were, but the therapist had certainly appeared at prior hearings, review hearings, and at the time of the contested hearing with regard to whether the family therapy sessions should be held in the mother's home or in a neutral setting, was asked to provide information to the court about concerns about moving the therapy into the home, and so potentially could have shared some things that might be otherwise privileged.
I got the impression from reading this in the timeline that the therapist was clearly, at least initially, not court-appointed to work on behalf of the court and do testing or evaluations, but rather was a therapist separately for the child. Was that right?
Absolutely.
But then at some point, did the therapist become a court-appointed expert or something? What was it?
Only to the extent that the therapist was called upon to offer opinions or update the court with regard to how things were going in therapy. So in fact, in this case, it was the maternal aunt who had arranged for the child to start seeing this particular therapist.
And counsel, I wanted to follow up on your earlier comment that the parties seem to agree that the GAL would be the proper party here to hold that privilege. In an ordinary situation, the GAL wouldn't have unfettered access to the therapist's file, and I'm wondering if you can offer to us what sort of parameters you would put around the scope of that privilege if the GAL were to hold it. I mean, if we were to say then, okay, in either a person to court order or under certain circumstances, the GAL then holds that privilege, what does that effectively mean? Only when the therapist shares information with the GAL, or does the GAL then have the right to go through and read all those notes and then determine what's appropriately shared beyond that?
I think that is actually the most difficult question raised by the case, and I believe the guardian ad litem will be addressing that further.
Okay.
But in the meantime, it does seem as though there would be a certain amount of sharing that is done, and there might also be a requirement that the trial court do an in-camera inspection of a file if there is a request for discovery of the entire file.
I guess I'm asking on behalf of the department, do you take a particular position of what the parameters would be?
You know, I do believe that the department has an independent interest and obligation to make recommendations to the court and get information from the therapist, whether it's the child's therapist or the family therapist. So I think what we're looking at is a requirement that there be a waiver, but a limited waiver. And I don't think, frankly, anyone necessarily needs access to the entire file in order to make recommendations to the court regarding permanency planning, regarding how the child's doing in therapy, and issues along those lines in terms of dispositional planning for the child. And I know we're running out of time here. The last thing I would like to just say is that when you look at the record as a whole and look at the testimony that was received by the court from all the other witnesses, the fact that the respondent mother here was not allowed to have access to the child's therapy notes would amount to harmless error in this case, along the lines of BBB people. Thank you very much.
May it please counsel, may it please the court. My name is Sherry Dans, attorney registration number 34794, representing the Office of the Child's Representative as amicus in this matter. Your honors, we put this in a slightly different order. Just logically, we thought I'd go next. Because we're short on time, I'm going to try to keep my argument very brief. The OCR very much appreciates the opportunity to participate in this proceeding. As the questions raised by Justice Coates demonstrate, This case is actually an opportunity to clarify the privacy interests of children in dependency and neglect proceedings, and it impacts GAL practice throughout Colorado. I think that what makes this case difficult, or one of the many things that makes this case difficult, is thinking about how the privilege applies to children in dependency and neglect proceedings. And what makes that difficult is that we are dealing with children who are actually dependent on adults for their day-to-day care, their guidance, and decisions. And what happens in a dependency and neglect proceeding is that because sometimes the parents are not in a position to provide that care, there are various adults who may need to know some information about what's going on in therapy with a child. Under federal and state privacy laws, the therapist must exercise his or her professional judgment to determine who the information can be shared with and what information can be shared. That is one question. But the question before this court is who in the proceeding gets to inject that information into the proceeding in a manner that opens it up for potentially very broad discovery by every other party in the proceeding. And conversely, who gets to block that information from being introduced into the proceeding?
So the guardian ad litem, let's just cut through it, is your recommendation?
Our recommendation.
As the only person who would be able to do that?
That is our recommendation.
Okay. Does the guardian ad litem get to look at the entire file in order to determine what should be limitedly waived?
Your Honor, I believe that that turns on federal and state privacy law, and I do think that the practice right now in Colorado, as far as we can tell, varies by jurisdiction, varies by therapist, varies to some extent by the relationship between the therapist and the guardian ad litem. I think that under Rule 1.2, the guardian ad litem has to exercise professional judgment and employ means that are in the best interests of the child. And I think all of that sits in the guardian ad litem strategy. The guardian ad litem will receive, because of 19.3203, some information from the therapist about how the child is doing, what the child's needs are. From that, the GAL has to make a decision, is this important to bring to the court's attention? Or do I need to ask for a decision from the court based on this information? And then the GAL has to engage in a strategy over whether to waive the privilege. Part of that strategy is determining whether to seek access to the entire file. As this court has recognized, access to the file itself is a form of disclosure, and the GAL does not need the full therapist file in every single case.
When you're done with your answer, can I ask a follow-up?
Go ahead. Go ahead.
If the GAL has the authority to waive the privilege, but they don't know what's in the entirety of the file, how do they do that with intelligence?
Your Honor, I believe that at the point at which the GAL believes that there is no other way to make the case to the court and that might require a waiver of the privilege, the GAL does then need to access the therapist's files. I believe that the way the GAL does that is, number one, by asking the therapist, I don't know under the federal privacy law whether therapists will readily turn over their psychotherapy notes. There are strict protections around that. I do believe that there are ways that the GAL can petition the court and get protective orders from the court that would allow the therapist to disclose the information to the GAL for the GAL to look at that file and consider whether or not to waive, to put forth a privilege log if necessary, to ask for limited orders around waiver.
So you have the GAL being the pivotal person, right, to determine the nature of the privilege, the scope of it. What about the other parties? What about the court? What about DHS? And then, of course, what about the rights of the mother?
Your Honor, I believe that there are some abrogations of the privilege in the Children's Code under 19.3311, all of the evaluations. I do believe that under any other information, I don't see an abrogation in the Children's Code. I do have concerns about the due process rights of parents. I think that this court has held in various criminal proceedings that relevance alone is not the test, that any infringement that assertion of a privilege might have on a party's cross-examination is outweighed by the important interest that this privilege serves.
What about the department?
Your Honor, I believe that goes back to the entity that's responsible for if the department has legal custody, the department will be getting some information from the therapist. I do not believe that. I'm very concerned about the idea that the department is a party who can inject that information into the proceedings. And
what about the court itself?
Your Honor, I believe that the court is dependent on the parties to bring the relevant information and the necessary information before it to make decisions in the best interests of the child.
Well, what about the ability of the court to do an in-camera inspection?
I believe that once the GAL makes the determination that privilege that to inject the information into the proceeding, the GAL can then ask the court to can employ a privilege log or can ask for a limited waiver, a balancing test similar to what this court recommended in bond under Rule 26C. And I think at that point is the point at which the court may conduct an in-camera review. But again, an in-camera review is a form of disclosure, and the first level of review has to be by the person whose sole responsibility is to advocate for the best interests of the child.
Did I understand you to say, though, even when you were talking about the GAL receiving this information and the possibility of it, that the GAL would have to get an order from the court? So although he's acting as an agent of the court, it's the court that's deciding whether or not to bring this information forward.
I believe that the practice is just so inconsistent in Colorado right now, but I do believe that some therapists, I believe under 19.3203, will share all information with the guardian ad litem, including therapist notes. Some GALs, I don't think it's been this formalized in the past. This will definitely be a change in practice, but I think that there is a way under the provisions regarding psychotherapy notes and HIPAA where the GAL may petition through the court for a court order that would allow access to the therapist notes by the GAL and the GAL alone. I think that's the kind of protective order that the court has the authority to enter.
If the court rule is that the GAL is basically the holder of the privilege in this kind of situation, why doesn't that satisfy HIPAA? Because that's now effectively an order of court. I don't quite understand that.
My understanding is that the personal representative under HIPAA is not the legal representative. It's the person who's
right.
making decisions.
But we have a case law ruling that it is.
I still don't think that the GAL is going to be the ultimate decision maker about who gets to whether the child gets to receive therapy, what kind of therapy. That goes back to the legal custodian. I do want to be respectful of Ms. Packer's time. Thank you.
May it please counsel, may it please the court. My name is Amy Packer. I am the GAL in this case. If I may start by answering some of the court's questions.
Yeah, why do you want this impossible job?
Because I truly believe that it's important to represent children. I truly do.
So then how can it be structured so that you're able to tightrope walk through these issues?
The only thing I can come up with, and this was after hours and maybe days of deliberation, is that the GAL needs to hold the privilege, that the GAL holds it from the inception of the case, that should I decide as the GAL to present that evidence to the court and to the other parties, I get a copy of the therapist's file because I do believe I need to know everything before I can effectively and intelligently make a waiver, that I then disclose that information with a privilege log. If there are concerns from the other side that I haven't disclosed appropriately, it would go to an in-camera review.
How would you propose, I guess through this privilege log, but how would you propose putting the other side, namely usually the parent, almost always, whose child is going to be taken away from them, putting them on notice that there may be information which the parent may want to know to use in cross-examination during termination of parental rights hearing?
And certainly I think that would be in the disclosure. I came from a civil background, and in civil cases we did disclosures. In these cases we don't. And I think it's because of the time. We have 1 year in cases where kids are under six to get children either back home or in a permanent home where they may be adopted. That doesn't allow for the time that it takes to obtain records from a therapist, to review those records, to then disclose them with a privilege log and all of those things. So it would be on a case-by-case basis, as Ms. Stan stated, that I would do this or that other GALs in the state would as well.
What would the privilege log look like?
The privilege log would be similar to what it is in a civil case.
So the child said, for example, the child said things to the therapist about whether she wanted to go home or not, or whether she felt safe in her home, but not what the child actually said.
Yes. Well, in the disclosure, I would likely, if I were bringing in statements about what the child said about wanting to come home, I would absolutely also include the statements to the contrary. Maybe I'm misunderstanding the court's question.
No, I guess what I'm concerned is how, if we put the privilege with the GAL, are we protecting the parent? And your proposal for protecting the parent, whose child might be taken away, is essentially to trust the GAL, who has to represent the interest of the child, but to trust the GAL to operate in good faith enough to put the parent on notice, whose interest might be contrary to yours, frankly, it is in this case,
yes,
to know to inquire further.
I believe so, but the GAL is considered a neutral in the case. There is case law that even after I make a recommendation to terminate parental rights, I still need to remain neutral. And if there are ongoing concerns, I believe those can be addressed by an in-camera review. And I see that I have 30 seconds, and we were hoping to retain time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Carrie Simpson, registration 35514. I am representing the respondent mother in this matter. I think the facts of this case are very important. The issue, as I see it, is whether a respondent parent has a right to full disclosure when it relates to an expert proffered by the state who will testify as to the termination of her parental rights. What happened in this case was somewhat unusual in the sense that the child therapist actually authored a letter, gave it to the guardian ad litem. The guardian ad litem, Ms. Packer, in my opinion, properly gave that information to the court. And the court based a ruling limiting parental rights upon the information in that letter. Important to note, the information in the letter was there were statements from the child made during the course of therapy in this letter. Later in the case, the court may be aware, later in the case when asked, all right, well, these were some statements made. What about other maybe positive statements the child may have made? The answers were, as happens, I don't recall, I'm not sure, I don't know. Eventually, after the letter was presented and mother's rights were limited as a result, her contact with the child was limited, there was a termination. And this expert, in addition to a caseworker and another expert, this child therapist was called to testify and did so. That's unique in dependency and neglect. But whether it's unique or not, what is not unique is the right of an individual, but particularly, in my opinion, it's heightened right when we're dealing with a fundamental liberty interest in your child. The heightened right to be able to examine the evidence being used against you. In this particular case, the opinion, I mean, it was an expert opinion proffered by the child therapist, was that there was a trauma bond. And the concern raised was, well, okay, when did you figure this out? If you're testifying that every contact the mother has with this child is traumatic, what have we been doing for the last year and a half by exposing the child? And I point out these facts because I think it's important to see these cases, these dependency and neglect cases, are treatment cases. They are, I guess delinquency might fit into this as well, but these juvenile cases are treatment cases, which puts them in a very different category than our civil cases, which deal with a one-time incident.
That's because the construct has treatment for the parents, perhaps, treatment for the child. It's supervised by the court overall, but there have to be professionals involved in this.
Absolutely.
Right? And the idea is to reunite the parent and the child. Isn't that the first objective of all these proceedings?
You know, the statutory, and this was addressed in the briefs, and I think by the court as well, the statutory objectives are twofold, the best interest of the child, and also making every reasonable effort to reunify the family whenever possible, strengthening the family. And what's interesting to me is the idea of privilege in these cases. The child therapist relationship, when it exists in a dependency and neglect case, is what I would call semi-permeable. I mean, realistically, the child walks into the therapist and says, okay, now I have to trust you. Obviously, a child may not say this, but I'm using this as an example. I need to trust you, and you're not going to tell anybody what I'm going to tell you, are you? And what is a therapist to say to that in a dependency and neglect action? They must report to the caseworker. They must report to the guardian ad litem. It's in the child's own best interest. And I thought, why are we viewing this in light of, okay, well, it's the parents, you know, they have an adverse interest, it's the parents. What about when the child reports to their therapist about a foster parent or a sibling or someone else in the home who may be harming or abusing the child?
Could I interrupt you right there just to make sure we understand what we're talking about? In the event that we really have a child abuse, there is no privilege, is there? Isn't there an obligation to report if there's really a crime being committed, if there's really a child abuse?
Well, that is true, Your Honor. However, a lot of these...
That would be true even apart from a dependency and neglect proceeding. Would that not be true?
Apart from a dependency and neglect proceeding, if a harm was communicated in therapy, yes, it would need to be reported. However, I would note, I don't believe that extends to emotional harm. In cases where, I've seen them, where a child says, my foster family tells me they hate me and they hate my mom and they're tired of this. That may be an exception.
So that's the point of your discussion here, is that kind of harm. That is, there would be no question with regard to a child abuse or a crime, right?
That's true, but I think, and perhaps I've gotten off point a little, but my main objective is to let the court know that it seems to me there is already in existence, again, what I would call a semi-permeable membrane in relation to this protected relationship. We're trying to protect this relationship for the best interest of the child, but we must pierce it also for the best interest of the child. I mean, it's...
Well, are you saying there's no privilege at all?
Not at all. I'm not saying that there's no privilege that exists, but I am saying when a parent is told your rights will be terminated, here's an expert opinion telling you why that parent is entitled to explore any possible bias, the basis for that opinion. They are entitled to explore perhaps other information that doesn't support that opinion. And what is unique in this particular type of case is if we have an opinion from, let's say, a PCI or even a psychological evaluation.
Explain what a PCI.
Oh, I'm sorry. If we have an opinion from a professional, usually a psychologist or a psychiatrist, who observes the parent and the child together, and they do a parent-child interactional, oftentimes that professional is asked to opine to the court, is this a relationship that we should be preserving? Should there be termination? Should there not be termination? When that occurs, realistically, the other party has an opportunity to not only review the basis for that opinion, but even get a second opinion. I mean, they can at least have the data reviewed for a second opinion. How do we get a second opinion on a child therapist? It's impossible. So when at the moment that is proffered as an expert opinion, the parent has no defense and therefore no due process rights unless they're entitled to a review.
Is your position basically that once the information is shared, that opens up the entire, all the notes, there's no such concept as limited waiver, anything like that? How would you resolve this case? What's your recommendation to us?
When an expert is proffered, either by the GAL or...
Oh, in this case, there are like two separate, really. There's this letter that details a lot of information, and then there's actual testimony. I guess there's a deposition as well, right? Before the termination?
There was a deposition, yes.
Of the termination proceeding. How do we resolve... how do we protect the interests of the mother from your perspective? With respect to the privilege.
I would say that when there is information proffered to the court in the form of an expert opinion.
Okay, that's this letter.
The letter.
Okay.
Or testimony.
Right. Well, I'm sure the information is also given to the caseworker as well, right?
Well, and that might become difficult. But I'll try to finish that statement and then address maybe a difficulty there where I'm not sure I have a resolution. But when that expert testimony is proffered, then there should be an in-camera review. And I have to say, I don't know a better attorney or person than Ms. Packer, but I don't agree that the GAL would be the one to do a precursory in-camera review. I think it needs to be an objective in-camera review by the court to determine what materials either contradict the opinion or a bias or whatever.
So every time an expert is going to testify in a DNN case, which is every case, almost isn't it? Virtually every case, 99% of the cases, the trial judge would get the information from the therapist and essentially start making trial almost tactic decisions. This is good for the mother, this is good for the child, and disclose that information.
Well, I should be more specific. Thank you. Typically in a dependency and neglect, the caseworker is the expert who testifies. And the respondent parent is entitled to all of the notes and all of the information that caseworker has used to come up with the expert opinion. The unique aspect of this case is that the child therapist was directly testifying to her own professional diagnosis and opinion.
Can I just interrupt for a second? I think it's really important from the point of view of our perspective that we look at the information and how it was given, and you know, almost chronologically, because it's different between having an expert testify, having a letter, and then I'm quite sure the caseworker was somewhat informed by whatever the therapist reports, right? So it'd be helpful to get, not to talk on that generalities, but to try to help us, because as I understand it, these cases take over a long period of time, and the therapist is involved with the child for a long period of time and giving reports verbally as well, right?
They are, and I would say I have two positions on this, if that makes sense.
I just want one. Would you also clarify how the caseworker relates to the GAL?
The caseworker and GAL can work in tandem. They can share information.
What's the caseworker's job as opposed to the GAL?
The caseworker's job is to really be an investigator and sort of coordinate the case as to both the parents and the child. So they do gather information directly from a child therapist, directly from the GAL. They can gather information from any source. Part of their job is to work with the respondent parents and help them accomplish a treatment goal, to the extent that they can. That is what their duty is. So in not trying to speak in generalities, I am focusing my argument on a child therapist as an expert.
Are you focusing on the termination hearing when you're actually proffered as an expert? Because that's the way your brief kind of reads.
It is, and
I make the analogy to an expert, you know, testifying for reals in a civil case.
It is, and disregard that part, because okay. I really do believe that the parental rights are so implicated in a treatment-oriented case. The moment that the judge must decide, you can't see the child. or these visits must be supervised, or these visits must be decreased. That changes the course of a dependency and neglect action. And therefore, I argue that because of that implication to parental rights, if a child therapist comes in, authors a report, testifies before the court and says, hey, stop these visits and here's why, at that juncture, the parent must have access to the information, or it's irreparable. That's irreparable. The case will continue.
What information? All the files?
All of the information that the therapist is basing their opinion on. When a therapist opines, judge, you need to stop these visits. We're not terminating yet. We haven't decided that. But judge, stop these visits between parent and child because they're harmful. And let me tell you why in a 5-page report.
So that would seem to be totally inconsistent with the child's best welfare in a case, assuming this is accurate, that there was trauma caused by the mother. So then that would totally destroy the trust between the client, and the child, and the therapist.
Well, not as long as the child isn't aware of what's happening in the proceedings. There's a strong objective, and parents' visits are often limited solely on the basis of inappropriate disclosures to the child about the case. I just would argue, Judge, that the child already knows, or it already exists for the child, that what they're going to be relaying in therapy is part of the case. There is no way for a juvenile judge to make a ruling about what is in the best interest of the child without, or termination of parental rights, without fully understanding what the child's mental state is and the basis for that.
You kind of touched on something that I think is essential, and that is you're implying that the child knows that information is going to go to parents. Am I understanding that correctly?
If I did say that, I didn't quite mean that, Your Honor.
That's why I'm asking, because the difficulty is a lot of times those recommendations are made, and it's early on in the case, and it may be the nature of the visits, you know, supervised, unsupervised, weekends, not weekends, right? Just to give us some background. The problem is the first time that information that the child gives to the therapist goes to mom, that maybe, you know, I don't feel safe with mom, or mom let boyfriend injure me in some way, and mom then says something in the visits, that therapist relationship is irreparably harmed as well. There's a lot of balancing. Do you agree in all of this?
I do agree with that.
So my question, I guess, is are you saying if any of that information comes in, it's an absolute waiver, or there needs to be a balancing test somehow between the need of the privilege, the rights of the parent, the best interests of the child, kind of a three-legged stool?
I would say an absolute privilege, Your Honor, because...
You mean absolute waiver?
Absolute waiver, I'm sorry, Your Honor, because there's a difficulty when we get to the juncture that the court is making this determination for the child, and the therapist testifies, and we have the concern that perhaps that therapist, that information that was testified to, the child might be confronted with that, and perhaps that might impact the parent-child relationship. I think that is, first off, more tangential or more uncertain of a risk than the very certainty that an inappropriate ruling based on a lack of evidence will lead to a termination. But more importantly, I think that the child therapist relationship is very important, but there can be a restoration for the child. There cannot be a restoration of the parents' due process rights. There can't, the relationship between the parent and the child supersedes, in my opinion, a specific relationship between the child and the parents.
Balancing is used in a lot of tests, and these difficult rights and duties and come up. I mean, due process is not an absolute value in and of itself. Doesn't the judge have to have some ability to make a balancing of these interests? I mean, the therapeutic result for the child is, after all, expert you're talking about is her or his major responsibility, right?
Yeah, I think protection comes into the in-camera review portion for one thing, but I do think that the problem is, how do we say you get some but not all? How does that protect the parents' due process?
Here's my question. You know, you want it at an early stage, but it seems to me by the time it gets to a termination hearing, there's some kind of threshold determination the judge is going to make that the proceedings have come to the situation where the child might have to be permanently placed somewhere else, or the termination of any parent-child relationship has to occur, right? So I can't quite understand. You've got a moving target on here. You said you want it on the front end. You need to see everything. It seems to me that when you look at this statute, you said it's a permeable privilege. Well, there has to be limitations on the privilege to accomplish what the statute wants to do, which is to try to rehabilitate the parent-child relationship if possible, while keeping the child safe in the meantime, and possibly terminating the relationship because it's in the child's best interest that it be terminated and that he or she be able to go on with another placement the rest of his or her life. So how can, given that situation, how can it not be a balancing test that the court has to make using its discretion?
Well, are there balancing tests, though, in the cases in cases where we're talking about a civil action and there's a privilege at issue? In we're talking about a dependency and neglect case in which the fundamental liberty interest in parenting your child is at issue.
A fit parent. The cases say a fit parent.
And there's no determination of fitness until the final proceeding at termination.
Okay.
Ms. Simpson, I'd like to get better your specific remedy that you want us to consider. And so I don't remember exactly the timeline, but this is a continuous problem, right? Information is going to the various people that we all know, some of it to the court, the court's making rulings, and eventually you got the determination, testimony, and so forth, hearing. And your brief focuses on the termination hearing and calling that person as an expert. And what I'm trying to get is, an example you gave to Justice Boatwright sounded like you wanted right off the bat, you wanted to have this waiver be complete. Is that to protect the due process rights of the mother? So I'm a little confused. What is it that we need to think about? I understand that there's a due process right of the mother. I understand that includes certainly a degree at the termination hearing, as the way you've written that brief, to cross-examine and so forth, and the effect of cross-examination. But how are we to look at this over a period of time, given the various statutory responsibilities that everybody has? So it would help me a lot. Do you want me to,
Well, I'll try to answer your question, Your Honor. First, I would say that the waiver that we're talking about, if it were, the waiver that I'm talking about is only if and when a child therapist presents to the court an expert opinion regarding something to do with parenting time or parenting rights. So I'm limiting it just to that situation. In that situation, because an expert opinion is proffered, due process requires the disclosure of what we've already talked about, the notes, the records.
So wait a minute, as applied to this case, the letter doesn't. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Did it happen before in this case?
I'm sorry?
Did it happen before? Because I'm sure there is information given by the therapist to the various parties.
Well,
the caseworker probably, and I assume the GAL.
Well, the letter, in my opinion, did it. It is arguable that when that information is conveyed to a caseworker and the caseworker uses it as a basis for opinion,
that's an arguable piercing of the privilege. I don't know that we have to go that far today, but certainly when a letter is proffered and during the course of a dependency and neglect case for the purpose of affecting parental rights in a very serious and permanent fashion, I think that that's when it's implicated. We don't have to wait for termination, and I think if we do, it will be too late for true due process.
In your brief, you say, I think what you're saying, the holding that you want us to reach is that there is a waiver whenever the child's mental health status is, you say, is the crux of the state's pursuit of termination. What do you mean by that? I mean, that would be every case, wouldn't it?
It might be a lot of cases. That's a more broad interpretation. I mean, it is.
I'm just quoting from what I think is your brief.
Right. And I do think that when a child has mental health concerns and the therapist is constantly affecting the case and the decisions made, the therapist is inserting her own opinion and belief into the case by virtue of other experts, the caseworker, and some, the GAL, who will make statements to the court and must investigate. When that happens, there, in my opinion, there is a reason to. I don't think that an expert should be allowed to give an expert opinion, hiding behind another expert opinion, and still allow the court to hear it without proper analysis of that opinion.
Your position has some logic to it. The problem maybe is that if we were to adopt your position, the child in a dependency neglect proceeding would have no safe harbor anywhere. Isn't that right? There would be no place, no one the child could talk to and really feel that conversation was private and would always be private. And I guess your response, not to make it for you, but your response would be, that's right. That's okay, because the purpose, once the court is involved, really all of these other interests are implicated. Is that right, or what's your feeling?
I think the protection comes in by consideration of the evidence presented.
But in terms of the treatment, the child isn't really capable of being treated. I mean, theoretically, the reason we have all of these people, a GAL and a caseworker and all of that, is to figure out what the best thing is for the child. Then I kind of look at this visually, and outside of that, perhaps, not in your opinion, there should be a therapist who is maybe helping the child get better and starting to work through all of this, even while the court case is going on.
I absolutely agree
with
that.
Sometimes those circles sort of intersect, and we're worried about what happens when those circles intersect.
I am, and Judge, I do agree that the child should have a safe harbor. The problem becomes, how can the state possibly make reasonable efforts and tell a parent, here's your treatment plan, comply with this treatment plan, but you don't get to know how your child's doing. But we think your rights should be terminated because, you know, the child can't see you. The child cannot see you. She's too traumatized by you. So that's the conundrum that it's an unavoidable conundrum. The parents in these cases have really a complete abrogation of any right they have to therapy, because they give over their, immediately in the case, they give over their release to any therapeutic treatment that they receive.
Would it be too broad to characterize your argument is that any information that is used in the, that is involved in the calculus of making an adverse decision to the parent must be disclosed to the parent in order to attack it?
Not at all. I don't think that that's
so
what
some things could be released to one side or be part of the decision and yet not be released to the mother? Is that what you're
two saying? Two different. They could be part, I guess, of a subjective position, but when it's presented to the court as evidence upon which the court should base a termination, I think that's the juncture. Quite often in these cases, the department and the GAL gather a lot of information that give them a lead, I mean, that make them feel this is what I need to make sure happens for this child. But if they start using some of this evidence and to proffer it to the court.
Okay, so anything that the court relies upon in making an adverse decision, you're saying the mother had to be disclosed to the mother?
Yes.
Counsel, can I just, you've been brought down the path of kind of saying everything has to, I want everything. Basically, that's kind of your position, but I want to draw you back to your original line, which was once the expert testifies. Are you abandoning that position?
I think.
You talk about the juncture, and I guess we've all asked you different junctures, and now anytime any adverse information is ever going to be used. But I guess I want to bring you back to your original position and ask you if you've abandoned that, which is once there's testimony in court, this is at issue, that's the point where the information must be shared. Can you help me with that? Or have you abandoned that position?
I haven't abandoned that position, Your Honor. I guess I'm taking in the alternatives positions. Maybe it's the trial court.
Sounds like you're extending it.
So, I will say, I do think, obviously, that's what I briefed, and I do think that actually, frankly, I think that's an easy decision for this court. I do think there is a much more difficult consideration that wasn't per se raised in this case, and that is, what about those expert opinions that hide behind other expert opinions? The expert, and that didn't happen because this therapist got up on the stand and testified. Does it happen? Probably. And I think there is a strong, a very compelling argument to say that when that happens and a parent has to weed through layers of expert opinions to figure out what the basis is, that's a due process
violation.
So if
the caseworker comes in and says, I think X, and one of the reasons I think X is because the therapist told me, that's enough in your mind to have to show the therapy notes.
I'm sorry, and I'm...
You can answer.
Sure.
Sorry, when a therapist...
Well, a therapist comes in and says, here's my opinion. Not the therapist, the caseworker comes in and says, here's my opinion, and I'm basing my opinion on what the therapist told me. That's enough in your mind and your argument to then open up the notes to the therapist?
Yes.
And irrespective of when that might take place in the proceeding?
No. Okay, and so that would, if that were to happen in the context of being in court and that caseworker giving a formal opinion about the parental rights, then yes.
Are there further questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Simpson. 23 seconds left.
May it please the court. It's our position that the balancing test needs to be applied in these cases, and that the Court of Appeals erred in not applying it. We believe that the trial court was correct, and we would ask that be the law of Colorado going forward. I will state that even with the Court of Appeals opinion saying that the GAL holds the privilege, I still have difficulty getting therapy records. So certainly, if an opinion comes from this court saying that I have the privilege, maybe that will help. I've had to fight with people, even with a court order, to get the records. They don't believe that a court order suffices.
I do want to ask you a question. I know that you must have conferred at times about this case with Ms. Stans.
Yes.
So what's your general joint position on this privilege law?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
I'm sorry, is there a joint position that you have with respect to the privilege law?
I believe
how it should be held, done.
I believe we both agree, and I can state that privilege logs have been used in civil cases for years, and very rarely does it go to the court for an in-camera review, because as attorneys, we know we have to disclose
information. I think we understand privilege logs. The question I wanted to find out is this a method that you all think is a good idea?
Yes, Your Honor. We have discussed it.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Did you want to say anything else? Well, thank you very much for your excellent briefs, your arguments. Case will be submitted on the brief.